This episode is brought to you by Adobe. Design at the speed of thought with Adobe XD, the first all-in-one UX UI solution for designing, sharing, and prototyping experiences. Try the free beta today. Go to userdefenders.com/XD to learn more.
Welcome to the User Defenders podcast, where we interview UX superheroes who fight for the users in order to inspire and equip you to do the same. And now, here's your host, Jason Ogle.
Greetings, User Defenders. Welcome to this very special episode all about the important message of cultivating a creative culture. Let me start out with this Seth Godin nugget I received recently. It seemed like the perfect opening to this important, very important episode. Repainting your house the same color it already was feels like a waste. It's a lot of effort merely to keep things as they are. But if you don't do it, time and entropy kick in and the house starts to fade. The same can be said for 1,000 elements of your organization, including your relationships with customers, staff, suppliers, and technology. The way you approach your market, the skill you bring to your craft, the culture in your organization, it constantly needs another coat of paint. Rust never sleeps. I love that. Creative workplace cultures. Possibly one of the last things we think about when looking for a job, especially when we're just starting out. Because, well, we need to get our foot in the door and we need to build experience. I totally get the importance of that. The flip side is that we as creatives can often find ourselves in environments that are anything but conducive to empowering and cultivating us to do our very best work. Today, I had the great privilege of interviewing the guy who quite literally wrote the book on creative cultures, Justin Dower. Defenders, I'll say it straight. If you're trying to understand and navigate what makes for a great creative culture and how to vet where you end up hanging your hat every day, this book is required reading. Justin and I get in the weeds of what constitutes a healthy creative culture. How can we make a difference in an unhealthy one? When is it time to leave? And so much more. Please enjoy and glean from this very special episode with the author of Cultivating a Creative Culture, Justin Dower. Justin Dower is a passionate user advocate, designer, writer, and denim elitist from Chicago. Through bloodshot tunnel vision, he's drawn from career experiences across agency side, client side, design studio, and pure tech to foster healthy, dynamic, supportive creative cultures. Crafting as the vice president of UX and development for B-Swift by day, his personal creative outlet by night and day is Pseudoroom, which also happens to be his Twitter handle. And by the way, he eats a bowl of cereal every night before bed, every night. Justin, welcome to User Defenders. I am super excited to have you on the show today.
Hey, Jason. Good morning. Thanks for having me.
I'm curious, what kind of cereal? Is it like one specific cereal that you have to have every night?
It is Cinnamon Life since I was about 5 years old.
Oh, my goodness. That sounds really yummy. I haven't heard of it.
Cinnamon Life? Oh, boy. Yeah, that's an old school cereal.
Oh, wow. So not Cinnamon Toast Crunch, right? That would probably drop you like...
If I'm feeling a little fancy, I'll go Toast Crunch, but
Cinnamon Life, right on. So this is a very special episode, Justin, and we want to talk all about your brand new book, Cultivating a Creative Culture. Now, this is such an important topic, and it's one that has had a direct impact on my life. And I would wager many of our listeners as well, our defenders listening, have either been impacted by a negative culture and or are about to be, unfortunately. So what I wanted to do here is I wanted to set the stage and testify with my story here, if I could, because I think that I think it's something, like I said, like whenever your publicist reached out to me about, you know, this opportunity, I was like, the content, I was just like, you know what? Yes, absolutely. I'd love to talk to Justin about this because it is an important issue. So here's my story. Okay, Justin, and everyone listening.
Sounds good.
All right. So in 2012, I accepted a job 1,000 miles away. I took a 40% pay cut, bought a house out here. We had just had our fifth child, and just shy of a year of my employment there, I was told I didn't have a job anymore. So, at the same time, even though a budget was cited for that reason, tens of thousands of dollars were being spent updating the outdoor signage.
Though the organization was huge, and it was a big one. There's so plenty of opportunities, I'm sure. And despite my plea to work in any other capacity until the numbers went up, I was shut down. I was just like, you know, I moved my whole family here for this job. I uprooted my entire family, and this is a big thing. This is a big deal. And now you're saying I don't have a job here. But it didn't matter. Apparently, there were no other opportunities available, and that was it. I was out. So what happened? There was a change of leadership. Okay. So the person that hired me ended up leaving the organization just a few months into my tenure there, my very, very short tenure. And the next, I think, 3 or 4 months were spent trying to find a replacement. I'll tell you, those 3 or 4 months was the best time there. I actually was entrusted. I was in a leadership role to lead design team, but it was actually the time I was entrusted to do my work that I was hired to do. And that all changed when the new leader came in, whose ego could hardly fit through a door. So, needless to say, there was a lot of challenge, and it all was summed up in the ego thing and just kind of about me. It's about me, not about you, in that leadership role. And I was never trusted after that. I was never trusted. No one's ideas mattered in the meetings except those in charge. A very high turnover there, so no one felt safe, especially creatives, to truly thrive in their work. Okay, so that's my story. That's my story. I've worked in bad cultures, and that was the epitome of it. And I know we're going to dive real deep into what makes a good culture and how we can affect change and where we are. But I want to just say, you know, as I just touched on my story, in the same way you can't know what bad coffee tastes like, and I know this is, you understand this, Justin, as a coffee connoisseur.
Speaking my language. Yep.
You can't understand what a bad cup tastes like until you've had a really good one. In the same way, you can't know what a good culture is until you've actually worked in a really bad one. Can you give us a backstory as to what inspired you to write this important book?
Yeah, absolutely. And first of all, I mean, your story, if you could see me on this, and lots of head shaking, and I actually felt some anxiety just listening to it because, you know, having a family of my own, I mean, that's absolutely devastating. And right away, I can see you were, the book centers on human-centered interactions quite a bit. We talk human-centered interactions in our work and how we deal outwardly with empathy and humility, but internalizing human-centered interactions should be devoid of ego, of course, and inclusive of ample humility. So you were relegated to a name on an Excel spreadsheet, more or less, and you know, it was just, okay, here's a name. We don't need this person. So that's mm-hmm. mortifying, and I'm sorry you had to deal with that.
Thank you.
For my part, my career, I've kind of vacillated between design side and tech side my entire career. Agencies, pure tech environments, pretty much since early 2000s, the dot-com era onward. So it's been a long career, but I mean, that experience, both positive and negative, directly influenced how I wrote in this book. So when I wrote a piece for A List Apart a couple years ago called Resetting Agency Culture, that piece at the time was very personal to me because I had worked at my last two or three roles in the agency space. And the agency space has some intrinsic issues with it, by and large, how time is valued internally. If you have internal job codes on your timesheet, people immediately feel, is my job on the line? Oh my God, I'm not billable enough. This whole thing about being billable. It's the way it's lorded over people. It's like a sort of Damocles with your job on the line. And it's just an absolutely horrible experience. So I had just come from a few agencies, not, you know, there were some positives and some negatives, but that was really the fuel for writing this A List Apart piece, and it resonated with their staff. And once the piece was published, you know, the feedback was phenomenal, but the feedback I was getting was kind of cross-industry. I was getting people from all kinds of media, print, radio, television, and, of course, digital, because that's the readership there. And, you know, that I let that resonate with me for a bit, and the feedback there really fueled me to take this further. This is a bigger topic than just the agency space. Creative culture really applies to product side. It applies to design side, service side. It's a really pervasive issue, and it's something when people's passions and the good work they can be doing is on the line. That's the most mortifying thing if those passions aren't fostered and they're let, you know, that spark is let to fizzle out. So that was really the impetus for the piece, and I've been you cited your personal story. I've worked in spaces before where if you wanted to go out and, you know, get a coffee or go downstairs and have a chat, you had to, you know, sign your name out and sign your name back in. And every minute your butt was outside that door, you had to make it back up.
It's like elementary school. Like, can I get a hall pass to go to the bathroom?
It is.
That's not human-centered.
Boy, you said it.
I love that term, human-centered interactions.
I mean, we use it amply and justifiably in the work we do outwardly, but really we're dealing with humans all day. We talk about, you know, putting ourselves in the shoes of others when we're crafting a persona, for example. We should be doing that exact same thing in our internal interactions. If we're putting work on the wall, we're in a feedback session, remove subjectivity altogether and have a nice flat structure where everyone's voice is equal. That's all what human-centered interactions is about, humility and respecting the other person you're talking to.
Ah, amen to that. Although the overarching message in the book can apply to any company suffering from bad culture, your focus in the book is particularly on creative cultures, as you just touched on. Now, what problems are you seeing in the creative workplace cultures today? You just cited one that you experienced personally about just, you know, the micromanagement factor of like not trusting the people, right? Enough to even just go outside for just a breath of fresh air.
Right.
What other problems are you seeing in the creative workplace culture?
Well, I'm focusing on designers and developers because really those are my people. I've worked in both disciplines. I've managed both disciplines, and really design and code are art. So the core takeaways from the book, humility, empathy, augmenting creativity, these are really applicable to any industry, as I cite with the Nick Cirillo story in chapter two, a pizzeria maker. And I kind of, you know, walk through how his business model of his level of humility and how he's supporting his team, you know, has made him a TEDx speaker.
Right.
So that said, in the workplace, I've seen designers and developers be relegated to production line workers, to yes men and women based on the whim or, you know, discretion of egotistical senior staff, which is, you know, is subjective, whim-based feedback is often very inclusive of that. So what happens is that these passionate people who pursue their disciplines to hone their abilities and endlessly improve lose that spark to evolve, to create, to become beacons of our industry in and of themselves. So that to me is the most tragic thing, where somebody comes in charged, you know, fresh out of school or from a different role, and they're bright eyed and they're ready to produce and contribute to the company and improve themselves. And, you know, they're just treated completely inhumanly. And it just is the biggest lost opportunity for individual, for passion, and for the business.
Yeah, that is such a good point about the spark, right? Because there is that excitement, especially when somebody's just starting out. And thankfully through this show, I've had the privilege of talking to some of my listeners and having Skype conversations with some that are just really fresh and just so hungry. And I'm a little envious that passion, you know, that they have, that excitement for the future and to apply their skills. And but you're right, like a bad culture can snuff that out, and it's not an easy repair. It is not an easy repair, because that is a psychological damage that occurs to somebody in a bad culture when they're not treated human, like a human. So I think that is actually, that is absolutely a really great point, especially in a creative culture. Like when we're expected to like churn out fresh ideas and inspiring creative and solve problems, when we're not trusted and we're not treated like humans, how is that possible? It's
yeah,
not.
Absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely. And Jason, I lead the book with an example that was really a personal one, where I would have this cycle where I would wrap up the work week on Friday. And as the day, you know, wore on Friday, my spirits would increase. Friday evening, I'm feeling phenomenal. Saturday, I'm having a great Saturday. Once Sunday rolled around, waking up Sunday morning, it was immediately in the back of my mind that, oh God, I have to go to work tomorrow. And the day, you know, the day would, I'd kind of have some fun on Sunday. Come Sunday evening, you know, when I'm sitting on the couch, I would just start playing the previous week back in my head. And I would revisit what happened. And I would think of the work pile on my desk. And I would think of, you know, that I have to get X amount of work done by EOD, or, you know, my supervisor's going to throw me under the bus. That's how I led the book, because it was a very personal mindset. And I found since that, you know, it's resonated very well with other people too.
Yeah. And it is a health, there's a health issue here. Right. I mean, I'm not trying to be over sensational. I think this is a reality. And that's why, like, I think this conversation is so important. And this book is so important, because it's not really talked about very much, but it is a hugely important issue, especially if for creative people wanting to do their best work. There are health issues involved. There is actually people who are languishing going into work on Monday after maybe enjoying a fairly good weekend, depending on how Friday went, right? Mm-hmm. The people who are in environments that are damaging to them are actually experiencing more heart disease than other people because of the stress. It actually could kill you. A bad workplace environment could kill you over time.
It's no joke.
Literally.
I mean, hypertension, having to visit therapists. These are all things, you know, I've personally had to deal with. And it's a personal topic, but it is absolutely one that is far reaching and, of course, pertinent.
Yeah. Well, I'd wager that one reason bad cultures exist, as we touched on before, is with egos. And that kind of can stem that the org chart doesn't help sometimes. Mm-hmm. Of like, look at how high up I am and look at you little people, and kind of how that can happen and how the little quote unquote little people are treated. You know, and then there's a whole movement about, you know, with flat management, especially in tech, I think. And some of the Silicon Valley companies have started implementing a lot of this flat management, where titles don't matter and everyone acts as though they're on the same level. Do you have thoughts on that? Have you seen any improvements in that kind of culture?
The first time I experienced that was actually maybe 5 to 7 years ago. I interviewed with Google, and the topic of title came up, and they just said, you'd be, I honestly forget, it was like you'd be a designer. But you come in and then you can, you know, you can elevate yourself as much as you are passionate and driven to do. But that's your title. And that, as a U.S. person, as an American, I'll touch on this in a second. That caused me to pause for a second. I thought, I don't know how that makes me feel. But ultimately, I'm all for flat management and everyone having an equal voice. Of course, this is the most human-centered of interactions, where it's people talking to people rather than those, you know, kind of in thrones versus those in floor seats. So I've seen the title mechanism as being a bit harder to adopt here in the States versus, you know, say Scandinavia, for example. People, you know, in the U.S. tend to like their titles, and I can see both sides of the discussion.
Sure.
Titles can clarify in client meetings, and they can, of course, intimate career progression on a resume or CV. Or the removal can augment a flattened org structure by truly leveling the playing field at all levels. So it's kind of a non-answer. I suppose the dower is still out on that one, but I do see the pros and cons there, because, you know, some people are very geared on career progression and you know, showing that in a very tangible sense as they go from role to role. And some people, titles really don't matter. Really don't matter. So it is the truest form of a flat structure. But, you know, I have yet to see it take a firm foothold in the U.S. market.
Yeah, that's interesting. I appreciate your honest answer on that, because titles, we can get a little caught up with it. Like you said, it is important in some ways, especially if you're looking for work. Somebody may just, that may be the only chance you get, is somebody to see what your titles were, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But I think that maybe, and I've not worked in a flat culture, but my assumption would be that maybe when it becomes challenging is when a really important decision needs to be made, and maybe one person makes it and the other people don't agree with it.
Right.
It's kind of like, well, who has the final word here, kind of thing. So I don't know. Yeah, maybe that could be a drawback to that as well. But what about remote cultures? I mean, remote work has become extremely popular. I think I just read a headline that Matt Mullenweg, WordPress founder, I think he just like closed his office completely. Like they had a lot of their workers were already remote, but I think he actually shut down the brick and mortar, and he's probably going to save a lot of money by doing that as well. But it's worked quite well for them. I think Basecamp is remote. I mean, there's a lot of companies that are remote and they seem to be thriving. And do you have any insight on that? Like, is that a kind of a good way to go? I mean, you're certainly less FaceTime involved with that, unless you're like unless Skype could be like an alternative. I don't know. What are your thoughts?
Well, the impetus for user interfacing there, of course, is more on the employee level. So there has to be a level of trust and respect that, you know, your coworkers and of course yourself are going to stay on top of that. But you, like you said, you see that model more and more. Like I think of like the WeWork space where people, entrepreneurs or startups kind of go into a collaborative space. They pay like a monthly fee or what have you, and they go in there and there's couches, there's meeting rooms, and people just kind of go in there and they meet if they have to, but then they go back to their home office. I am all about working away from your desk, and I think, you know, taking that to the next level of closing down brick and mortar, I think it's a completely intuitive and logical way to go about it, because why do people have to be in the office? And again, I cited kind of a U.S. versus Scandinavian mindset with titles. I am very passionate about people drawing inspiration away from the viewport. And this is a chapter in the book even, where, you know, it's very easy to pull up like, you know, some awards, online awards site and cycle through tabs and be like, oh, okay, they have a nice hero image. Oh, that's a nice interaction. And then your inspiration just fizzles to that point. But there's so much away from the office, away from the digital world, away from our seats and our butts being in a chair that we can cull and pull back into our daily work. So the confines of the office to me are, you know, not something I'm incredibly married to. And I think closing down brick and mortar is a very, you know, logical and feasible business model.
Yeah, and I appreciate you also mentioning about the stepping away from the viewport, and that was a great chapter too. And I love your examples too. Like you are an example, like which I think that a lot of this has to do with leadership. Culture is really established and trickled down through leadership, and I like how you're being that example, and especially when you have new hires. Like I love your process, Justin. It's so refreshing. Like you don't your day ones typically day ones are they start on Monday,
right?
And that's just something. Oh, it's the beginning of the week. Let's just make day one. Like, but this almost seems like maybe there's not as much thought put into why do we do it on Mondays? I love how you do it on Fridays. Why don't you tell a story about how your day ones work and maybe just a quick overview?
Yeah, absolutely. So really the day one is, as I break it down, is broken out across four main elements: acclimation, conversation, inspiration, and reflection. Day one, Monday, is a fairly standard industry thing. I mean, it makes sense. Somebody comes in on Monday, you know, they're greeted at the door, hopefully, and they're in training the rest of the week, or, you know, God forbid, they're thrown into a client project within the first hour, which has happened to me. I can laugh now, but, you know, that's happened. So the momentum there and bringing someone in on Monday, it's easy. It's a layup. Someone comes in Monday, they work through Friday, and you know, there you go. The momentum I am looking for is one much more of positive energy of somebody absorbing what just occurred and taking that through the weekend and telling their friends and telling their family and coming in on the following Monday and then being charged to actually work. So what I call the new day one, acclimation is someone coming in. I'm greeting them at the door. We're having a conversation and maybe doing some introductions here and there. But I don't want to, like, you know, have flooding, that flooding mentality where, you know, they're just shaking hands. Who's this name? Who's that name? Again, we want to, you know, be as the golden rule, treat others the way you want to be treated. I want to put myself in the mindset of this person coming through the door. So acclimation is just, you know, bring the person to their desk and we're not stumbling or fumbling. Oh, you know, where's their laptop? Where's their mouse? everything's there for them already.
Right.
We've prepared for this moment. This person is entrusting us with their passion and their career. Let's reward them for that. So their workstation is set up. Maybe there's a card on their desk that people have signed welcoming them. These are things I'd like to feel going in. So I want, you know, my new employee to feel the same way. And then there's just an organic dialogue. You know, if they're asking, you know, what do we use for, are we using Dropbox or Box? And, you know, we kind of talk through that. Or they ask, Are we using Git or TFS for source code management? And I could say, you know, my front-end manager over here can feel that. There's an organic dialogue there that starts happening rather than saying, this is Bob, this is Chuck, this is Jane. And, you know, people just start to learn names through conversation.
Yeah, they'll maybe remember one name.
Yeah, I'm terrible at names.
Me too.
I mean, I probably remember zero. Acclimation conversation, the day would wrap up around noon. And the conversation part, I'll tell people, okay, you know, our day in the office is done now. Pack up your things. And then I'll have a pre-selected lunch place lined up. You know, again, I'm not like, oh, I have to look on Yelp and find a place nearby. Everything is very smooth and easily transitioned. So the person feels, again, we have our act together.
Yes.
So we're going to a lunch place. At this point, the conversation is kind of more about family and you know, how long have you been in Chicago? I'm a Chicagoan.
Yes.
Things like that. We're keeping it loose because people are going to have food in their mouths and they don't want to feel like they're scrutinized. And after that, we'll go to a coffee shop, and then we talk coffee again.
Oh, yeah.
We'll talk a little more about what is my design process? What is this person's, what are they hoping to get out of the role? And I'll talk a little about our current clients and things like that. We'll get a little more in the weeds. After that is the inspiration part. And this is where, you know, as that coffee session is wrapping up, I'll say, take me someplace in the city that has inspired you. And at that moment, I've gotten everything from, you know, it's a natural thing. I'm kind of putting the person on the spot. I've gotten the deer in headlights look. I've gotten, you know, instantaneous answers. And sometimes the person, you know, can't think of something, and I'll have something lined up.
Yeah.
And we've, you know, it's been anything from, you know, it could be, I work by the lake, so it could be going by the lakefront if that's inspired this person. It could be going to a comic book shop. And, you know, if we're going to this place, it's not just we're going to go there, I'm going to take an Instagram pic and be like, okay, have a nice day. We're going to talk through why? How does this inspiration re-inform the person and the work they're doing? I mean, I get so much more from this rather than what I can call from a folio PDF, because I can genuinely see what is this person's design thinking, what is their, what is fueling the way they visually communicate and how they approach their work. And after inspiration, then the day kind of, you know, wraps up at that point. And that's what we call reflection. And the person is going to take this first day, and I've had everything from people welling up with tears to I've been hugged to, you know, people are genuinely touched that they've been treated like a human being.
Yes.
And I mean, think about that for a minute. This is like, this should be the most natural thing in the world, that this we're recognizing this person as a person and respecting them.
Yeah.
And you can tell people have been burned and their creativity has been snuffed out, and that's being reignited. So. That's really like how I like to run a day one, and I've chatted with other people about this, and this seems like to be the thing that resonates quite a bit. I don't know if it's because it's early in the book, and also the thing that people are willing to adopt straight away, which is a great sign because this is really the impetus for a creative culture right here.
I love it. It's so great. It's getting a little dusty for me, man, just hearing that story again. honestly, I love your approach, man. And I think, and I hope that people follow suit and try this with the day one and actually put a lot of planning into kind of how that operates and being prepared like you are with kind of places to go and about also leaving it open ended, letting them kind of like, you know, what are you like? Where do you want to go? And
right.
Again, it's kind of turning the tables. It's like, it's the focus is on them, right? And it's like people are the most important asset in any company. They are absolutely the most important, and that what better way to start off than letting somebody feel that they are, and then just kind of starting kicking things off right there. And what a great weekend, going into a great weekend, excited for Monday,
right?
Imagine that.
Exactly.
Oh man, so I'll tell you, Justin, and I think this is a no-brainer based on kind of how I started this conversation off with my story. I will never ever apply for a job without completely feeling out the culture. I will never do it again. And this kind of leads me to my next question, you know, and I think that one of the things that makes for a great creative culture is in hiring the right people, but this also includes being the right person. I wrote an article called Don't Be Culture Clubbed, which was kind of inspired by the story I told earlier. I encourage any creative person interviewing for a job, make sure you turn the tables, whether invited to or not. You know, because typically we'll get an opportunity when we interview others, we'll give them the opportunity. Do you have any questions? And or we'll be given that opportunity. So I want to encourage people to make sure they take advantage of that and feel out the culture. If, you know, find out what kind of creative culture this is and how they're fostering that. You know, what are some of the best questions you found to ask to get a strong feeling during that interview, during that one opportunity you may have to feel it out?
Yeah, I mean, well, first of all, Don't Be Culture Clubbed is a phenomenal title. I have I'll Thank tumble you. For you in my head right now, so thanks for that.
Sorry about that.
No, that's all right. I'll live. So I've kind of blown this one in the past. There are some standard things if you look up. If you just Google, what should I ask during an interview? They're the standard things. Where do you see yourself in 5 years? How do you, I mean, you know, there's some layup questions there.
Yeah.
So in the book, I actually call this the mutual interview because you're really on the same plane at this point, interviewer and interviewee. You want to find the culture that you're entrusting with supporting you and your gifts. So stock questions from the business's side, of course, have their business value. Like, you know, tell me an area you feel needs improvement and things like that. You should have the answers queued up for that. But you also have to have to consider what is not being asked. So have you been asked about who inspires you and what you do, how you maintain that inspiration or convey it to your team, what you read to stay on top of your craft's evolution, how often you attend or speak at events or lectures or meetups? These are questions that speak to passion and to energy, and a creative culture cares deeply about these things. So as far as questions to ask in advance of the interview, pick a few things that are of utmost importance to you and to doing your best work. So, you know, for example, if the ability to work offsite is you know, very core to you, we touched on that, or how are employees onboarded, or how is performance measured, and, you know, and see if, you know, billable hours comes up at that point, big red flag. So, you know, are people supported with training or the ability to attend conferences and hackathons? Would I be able to learn other areas of the business? These, if the culture is genuinely passionate about what they do and about supporting you and your passions and an evolving as a creative person, these are layup questions. If you're getting flop sweat, if you're getting stumbles, if you're getting those are red flags. So this should be the most organic of dialogues at this point. And when somebody reflects this back at me, if I'm interviewing somebody, I mean, this is the most welcome dialogue. I just light up like a Christmas tree because you can tell someone is genuinely probing and they care about the job that they're interviewing for. And in return, I need to care about potentially having the ultimate gift of their passion in my hands. So it's the most valuable time right then.
I love that. And another thing that I was thinking about right now was about developing people. And I'm blessed right now to work where I work. It's a great culture and all across the board. And a lot of that has to do with the emphasis on developing the people. And I think maybe there's a way like to ask about, or maybe it's important to ask, you know, what kind of philosophy takes place here on developing the people, right? Like conferences, training, and because to me that shows that like the core of the company is going to be focusing on the people, right?
Right.
So that
right.
can trickle into other areas too that are important. Would you agree with that?
I absolutely would agree with that. And in my most recent role, I mean, I very directly asked about that. It's a nice sign when somebody's signing up or you're joining a business and they'll send you to a conference. That's a phenomenal demonstration of, you know, supporting evolution and supporting, you know, people training and improving their skill sets. But, you know, in my last role, for example, I and a colleague of mine, Andreas Carlson, we started this hackathon program called Winter Camp and an iteration on that called X Camp, which took that a step further. So we had a baseline of a very strong creative culture, and we went to the owners of the company and we put it before them. You know, what if we took this model of sending people to camp and we instead took, you know, maybe 10 to a dozen people remotely, and we had our own mini conference where, you know, we had blown out the cost in advance and it came to like a third of like sending someone to a, you know, standard like conference offering. Mm-hmm. And in that hackathon environment, you know, completely off site, completely in the woods, and Clear Left has done a phenomenal job of this with their hack farm concept. That was our model for doing this. So, you know, if someone is asking about camps, and this is what I did in my most recent interview, asking about conferences, I said, you know, my last business, I proposed this idea of camps. And is this something, you know, in a leadership role in this new company, you would be amicable to my doing? And they said, absolutely. If you put forth a business plan and, you know, we saw the cost, you know, we'd be all for this. So these are questions you should absolutely ask. If you bring up conferences and they said yes, you know, take it a step further, you know, see what they're amicable to. See if they say that's something we'd be interested in or you know, we were open to it or not. So, you know, there are the stock questions, and never be afraid. This is a dialogue. This is a conversation. You know, this can evolve just like our interview here, our conversation right now. This can evolve in any of a million different directions. So, you know, just be open and be fluid and just really stay true to your core as you're talking to a potential employer.
That's great advice. I love the idea, too, of just taking it offsite. You don't have to spend, you know, thousands of dollars necessarily to just get everybody in the same room away from the office, even if it's just like an inspirational trip to the art museum or what have you. Like, and just getting the people together, just to show them that they matter. Like, it's about the team. It's about the people that make things happen. So I love that idea, too. And as you mentioned, Andy Budd, like, he's just been a great example of that as well. And you mentioned him in the book, which...
Yes.
I loved reading about some of the things that he's been doing too. And there's a quote I actually put this in my notes because I just loved it so much. And it's about, you know, trusting people. And he says, you know, how about this crazy idea where we hire smart people, we get out of their way, and we let them solve the problems?
I had the same reaction. I mean, you can count on Andy to cut through the crap and just get to the core of things. And
that's
he's
exactly
just
right.
Filled with anecdotes like that. He's an absolutely brilliant man. But yeah, again, it's an air quotes crazy notion to get out of the people's way and let them do what they're hired to do.
Yes. I love it.
Design at the speed of thought with Adobe XD, the first all-in-one UX UI solution for creating beautiful, interactive user experiences for websites and desktop or mobile apps. Adobe XD helps you design, prototype, and even share your experiences with your teammates and stakeholders for feedback. Try the free beta for Mac or Windows today. Go to userdefenders.com/XD to learn more.
So this next one is... It's kind of a challenging one, but I think it's important that it's an important area that I think we should address because it's scary to leave a company. It's scary, especially if you have mouths to feed. I think we tend to kind of put up with abuse in a bad culture because we're just so afraid of the whole transition. And it's not easy. It is not. But before I ask this question, I just want to kind of cite something that happened, which was it was kind of like an evidence of the culture where I worked, when I talked about. So basically I was laid off. And two other people on the team were laid off the same week that he was hiring in. This person was hiring in another person to kind of take my place, right? And when this person found out in a meeting that three of us were leaving in the same week, this guy, he left. He left the company. He left immediately. Like, he just did an about face and he was out.
Wow.
So it's an example. Like, it's very, you know, even if, you know, a bad leader will try to sweep those things under the rug, it's apparent to everybody. And it's only a matter of time before it gets out. But that's an example. This person had the courage to just go, I spend more time at work. I'd rather not work in an environment where three people are getting laid off in the same week for really no good reason. It was personal. Okay. Bottom line, it was personal. So all that to say, you know, we can often find ourselves in awful cultures and forget that at will employment doesn't just mean theirs. It also means ours. Yet we find ourselves enduring the punishment of abuse day in and out. In the book, you say it's far better to sever ties quickly than to languish in a situation you absolutely know is wrong for you. I love that. You know, what are some clear indicators that it's just time to leave?
Well, to the example you just cited with your former coworker, I also have a notion in the book that I cite called never settle. And I genuinely believe in that after, a longish career. Never settle for anything less than what is the optimal situation for you and your passions. And, before I was at my the previous company, I left because the culture was clearly toxic, and we'll talk about what those indicators were there. I left, and I have a family, and I just I couldn't do it anymore. And I just did kind of the same thing. An about face, I left nothing lined up. And I took 3 months to really just think, what is it I want to do? Do I want to teach? Do I want to take on a completely different craft? Do I want, you know, what do I want to do? I was dialing into the core of what my passions were. And, you know, over those 3 months, I did a lot of freelancing. I busted my butt, you know, to bring money in and pay the bills. But those 3 months of clarity were so key to me and my creative energy. So to the point of never settling, and what are some clear indicators that it's time to leave? Management that fails to support the culture in any healthy capacity. You talked about ego. Ego is absolutely toxic and cancerous.
Yes.
Pervasive backseat creative directing or managing. It sounds like something, haha, we can laugh it off, or it's a web comic. That directly is about, that directly relates to ego. It directly relates to belittlement and you know, it's tantamount to psychological abuse. Lack of support towards training, employees having their value qualified by who's at the desk longest or who's the last one out the door or who got through the biggest pile of work on their desk on any given day. That directly speaks to lack of humanity and lack of empathy. So, I mean, you know, some places can be really terrible in practice and portray themselves one way via their external brand and are actually another beast altogether on the day to day. So, again, this is why the mutual interview is so very key to dig into these, you know, potentially cancerous situations before you're actually in them.
So good, Justin. Defenders, your ego is not your amigo.
That's a t-shirt.
Yeah, I think so. That's a great, I'll have to make one. That's awesome. So culture always trickles from the top down. It always does. How can this is a question that I think is a really important one, because I have no idea. I don't know what the answer is to this. And I know, and you may not have the answer either, but I know you can shed light on this. And I know you've done a lot of homework and a lot of experience in this way. But can a creative not in senior leadership working in an awful culture actually affect change in their workplace? And if so, how?
Sure. So the point of culture trickling down from the top down is key, because if a culture is poisonous, at some juncture, there's a vital conversation to be had with someone very senior. So who has it? Is it your manager on your behalf, for example? Then that depends on he or she having complete buy-in on the culture and its advocacy and, you know, your advocacy as well. In this situation, it's up to the individual to decide if they're settling. We just talked about never settle.
Yes.
You can form a bubble culture within a larger, not fully healthy culture wherein, you know, you're providing healthy and unsubjective feedback to one another in your own feedback sessions. You're, you know, holding mini inspiration meetings amongst your team, et cetera. But ultimately, it's up to the person to decide, is this enough? Am I truly flowering or am I actually floundering? So, you know, if you're a junior level employee or mid-level employee or, you know, seniority agnostic, really, there's a point at which someone is the cultural stakeholder, and they have to decide, and you'll have to intimate from this conversation, is this person genuinely passionate about the culture and my passion's well-being? So that is, you can influence it to a point, but, you know, let's just be completely honest here. At some point, it's going to hit a juncture where someone needs to make that decision.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's absolutely true. I appreciate the honesty behind that as well, and not holding any punches back. There's really no pill, right? There's no quick solution to that. But I think it's just being sensitive to your environment, hopefully vetting it out before you sign the contract, as you say in the book, and just being aware, having that awareness, and trying to be that change too, right? That we want to see in the world, as Gandhi would say, trying to be that example internally. And if that's not working, it might be time to go, huh?
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. I'm Dan Mall. I'm a husband, a dad, and the founder and director of Design Collaborative in Philadelphia called Super Friendly. And now to you, dear listener, use your super hearing to listen to the User Defenders podcast with Jason Ogle.
So as the great Simon Sinek says, and I love his work as well, Leaders Eat Last was an incredible book on leadership as well and workplace cultures. But he says, you know, people don't leave companies, they leave leaders. And I want you to speak right now to those in leadership, because as we mentioned, and I think this whole conversation is pointing to the fact that if you're a leader, you have a big responsibility, and it's on you to really create the best possible culture for your people. So I want you to speak to those people right now. I want you to speak to those folks who are in leadership and having a very direct impact on the culture. How can they create and foster the best possible working culture for creatives and hopefully everyone in the organization for that matter?
As a leader, you are holding people's passion and dedication and creative fire in your hands. Mm. And it's the most non-trivial gift to be privileged to. Fostering that passion does nothing short of propel your business forward, both in quality of work and the bottom line. Because really, if someone listening is a decision maker, or someone reading the book is the one who owns the business and is responsible for people's paychecks and health insurance, quality of work and people being charged to come in directly impacts profit and bottom line. So there's a tangible benefit to this. So a happy employee is a charged, inspired worker. I say that in the book.
Yes.
So to leadership, be the cultural champion. Set the tone and ensure your brand and culture are synonymous. So what people are signing up for is exactly what they get. If you are the one responsible for keeping the lights on, you know, as a leader, empower other people to then be the cultural champions. Of course, you're the one who is ultimately responsible for this as your business. But are you forming a small advisory group, let's say, of half a dozen people to ensure things are on the day to day, or the culture is being saturated in all these kind of micro interactions? Or is it management that you're empowering, or what have you? At some point, you are the one ultimately responsible for the culture. So be the cultural champion.
I love it.
Ensure the culture is a known quantity to everyone. So, Jason, early in the interview, you mentioned people know when they're signing up for a good culture because they've been burned previously in another role. What about people who are green, or people yes. right out of school? How do those people who are coming aboard know that what the creative culture affords can be fully seized upon? So, for example, how do people know that I can get out of my chair and go work out of a coffee shop, or I can work from home on X days a week, or there's flex time where if I have a family, I'm fully supported to leave a little early and go pick up my daughter from school? Ensure the culture is a known quantity to everyone. That could be, putting little flyers on a coffee table in the lobby that cite, what people can and can't do. I think Government Digital Services in the UK, does something similar to that. So just make sure people know that it's not like X person isn't privileged that they can get up and leave. This is available to everyone to, kind of seize the benefits of the culture. And lastly, the physical space of the office is paramount. So I mentioned the WeWork model before, where people are coming in and the space is kind of, loungy, and, there are certainly little offices you can duck into, but that coffee shop vibe is baked into that because there's a completely different energy there to be seized upon. So your physical workspace, is it currently high wall cubicles and all senior management is in offices with the door closed, or is it as much as you're able to with the physical walls you're dealt with? Is it an open environment where people can pause to have coffee and, the coffee machine isn't set on a pedestal with nothing around it? Can people sit there and have coffee and chat with their coworkers about their day, about their family, or about projects, something I've just read on a list of part online or a TEDx talk I've seen? And, kind of the creative energy then flows from the desk to the coffee machine to the lunch table. And it's a never-ending cycle, people being charged about one another and doing their work. Are there places to work away from their desk? Are there beanbags? Are there couches? Is there a quiet room? Are there, whatever. Are people empowered within the space to kind of move around and obtain the best energy as they see fit? And lastly, areas for play and exploration within the office. I cite, the play concept within the book, where is there an area where people can get out of their chair and just work out the negative energy and work through their visual or programmatic problem solving in a completely different tangible medium? Are there Legos? Is there a puzzle? Is there an inkwell with brushes where people can just, get it out and utilize this space and not feel like there's a judgy eye, like, oh, look at Frank is over there building Legos again. I mean, do people know that they can get up and do this and get it out and work things out? And again, this speaks to ensuring the culture is a known quantity. So I feel with those three things as a leader, they're non-trivial things, of course. I'm not downplaying that. Those three things as a leader will absolutely ensure you're on the right path to a creative culture.
You can't just put a ping pong table or foosball table in the office and think that's good enough. You have to genuinely care about every human being that serves and that spends a lot of time away from their family to do this work. You have to genuinely care. I've said this before, and I hold to this. It's great leaders are the first to take the fall and the last to take the credit. And this has been so awesome, Justin. There's so much to take away from in this, and I really, truly hope that this inspires many to they themselves to be a great impact on the culture, but especially for leaders to really take that responsibility and do everything in their power to make the places that people spend so much time in every day, to make it a great place to be and a great place to thrive for creatives. And your book, Justin, is incredible. It's just enough. It's not super long. It's not super short. It's just enough to really get this message. And there's so much more in the book that we haven't even talked about, that we wouldn't have time to talk about. But I just want to encourage defenders listening, pick up the book. It's amazing. So I just appreciate you being here, Justin. As we close, is there anything else you want to leave us with that maybe I haven't asked you yet?
No, just generally, you know, I'll come back. This is the closing of the book, and I've said this a copious amount of times in our dialogue. Just, you know, never settle, truly, in your career. Ultimately, it comes out to looking out for yourself and your passions and doing your best work. And as creative people, again, I say it towards designers, experienced people, people who work in programmatic problem solving, really doing your best work is what it's all about. We get into this field as passionate individuals. We go to school because we want to, you know, hone our craft. We get into this professionally because it's what we want to do. The genuinely passionate people are coming into the office doing work, and they're going back home at night, and they're tearing apart code on their laptop, or they're going through, some article via the AIGA site and seeing how somebody attacks in visual problem solving. People never turn it off who are genuinely passionate about what they're doing. And you have to recognize that within yourself and be respectful to yourself and your craft ultimately.
Oh, so good, Justin. Thank you for writing this book. Thank you for getting this message out. And thank you for being here with me today. This has been incredible. I cannot wait to share this episode, Justin. And I just want to say, fight on, my friend.
Oh, thanks very much, Jason. I appreciate the conversation today.
We spend more time at work than we do with our loved ones. That's why we should never settle when it comes to working in cultures that don't value us or our contributions. If you find yourself in a place where the people keeping the gears turning are treated like cogs, the people keeping the lights on are viewed as a flickering commodity, the people starting good things are merely a means to an end, it may be time to leave. You can and should certainly try your hardest to, as Gandhi says, be the change you want to see in your workplace, but cultures always, always trickle from the top down. So unless you find yourself in a C-level seat, hey, good for you, you've got a long and very possibly unwinnable and very unhealthy uphill battle ahead of you. It always boils down to leadership. Vet the leadership however you can, be that through networking with someone who works where you're wanting to work, or maybe get a feel for how much they invest in developing their people, because that's also a great litmus test to how much they value their people. I love my time with Justin, and this episode will go down as a reference for me next time I find myself pounding the pavement looking for the right creative place to be the right creative person. I highly, highly recommend picking up the book. I'll be sure to have a link in the show notes. Also, I'm super delighted to share that I have an extra copy that Justin's wonderful publicist, Sarah Wiggle, I hope I said that right, gave me to give away to you, Defenders. I'm going to do this through Twitter, so be sure to follow @UserDefenders so you don't miss the announcement about this exciting giveaway. Speaking of Twitter, after you follow User Defenders, please tweet your greatest takeaways from this special episode. I want to thank Chris Combs for the extraordinary editing, and until next time, fight on, my friends.